Welcome to Good Life. I'm Dean Wilson. So grateful that you're with us. If you're watching us on television here in the Santa Barbara, California area, we welcome you. Great to have you at TVSB. And then so many of you joining us all around the world at goodlifetelevision.org and the YouTube channel and the podcast and all these different places you can find us, social media platforms. We're just grateful. Grateful that you're with us. And you can watch all the long-form interviews, these amazing people, all walks of life, ages and stages, experiences. We don't ignore suffering, but we do try to dwell on the hope and the good things and overcoming. And we've had some amazing people to help us do that, these guests over the last few years. And so we're grateful for you. Grateful for Bunnin Chevrolet, our friends there who are supporters. And I'm really excited to welcome my guest today. Collier Landry is with me. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We just got done talking about bees for a while. We're in the backyard here. We've had this bee problem. So if you see us flinch, you'll know. But I did. Turns out he's a bee expert also.
I'm a wealth of useless knowledge, for sure.
Well, today it came in handy. I know. Now I know. If you're dressed in black, they think you're a bear. So that's where you have danger with bees.
There you have it.
These are the things you learn about on Good Life. So Collier's an artist. He's cinematographer, podcast, and he's an award-winning documentary filmmaker, which we're going to talk a lot about. And he gained a lot of attention as the creator and subject of a murder in Mansfield, which we will also be talking about. And so he's got a passion for storytelling. He's really a multi-talented guy, and I'm pleased and excited to have him here with me. His if you check him out on YouTube, you'll see him. He's like a lot of views, a lot, like billion with a B. So how did you, before we get into your real story and what's happened here, but where were you raised, early life? Ohio?
So early life, I lived in Virginia till I was about 5 years old. Okay. And then I moved to a small town called Mansfield, Ohio.
Okay.
Which your audience will probably know if they haven't seen my film. But there's a very famous film named Shawshank Redemption,
yes,
which was filmed there. And the prison, the entire town, everything was all
really
pretty much.
It's my favorite movie, actually.
It's a fabulous movie and one of my top five of all time.
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of movie I will watch over and over again.
100%. Say Watanabe. We're all trying to get to say Watanabe. I'm being cheeky,
no,
but I'm also being serious.
So right.
And what's ironic is that story, in a lot of ways, parallels my own, and with a murder of a wife, and you know, all of these things, and so and then to be shot in my hometown, and it's
weird, isn't it?
It's very strange.
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Okay, so let's just go there in terms of like, take us back to what happened. And then what has brought about in your life since?
Sure. So when I was 11 years old, I woke in the middle of the night to the sound of two loud thuds. This was on New Year's Eve, 1989, so I'm going to date myself. Mm-hmm. But and I had heard a scream. I knew at that moment, because I grew up, take it back a little bit. I grew up like every normal child, thinking that what my reality was what normal kids go through, right? I had a mother and a father that I knew that loved me, but I also grew up with a lot of turbulence in the home. My father was a doctor, but my father also had a proclivity for womanizing and for violence. Now, I didn't know about the womanizing part until much later, but I certainly knew about the violence and growing up in a sort of fight, flight, appease mode. He was very apoplectic, you know, drop of a hat could just rageaholic, etc. Right. Yeah. Normally a lot of people equate this with substance abuse or usage, alcoholism, things yeah. like that. My father was none of those, right? He was just, as what we all come to find out, was a psychopath. And, but I just thought that was the life that I had, right? In the summer of 1989, my parents, my mother, unbeknownst to me, my mother had drew this line in the sand with my father, which was like, look, Jack, you can do, my father's name is Dr. John Boyle, but he went by Jack. My mother's name is Noreen. And she said, look, Jack, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't involve our son, meaning the womanizing part. Mm-hmm. Well, on Father's Day that year, I saw him, he introduced me to a woman that was at that time pregnant that I didn't even know, that was his girlfriend. And he kissed her and she was wearing a ring that was my mother's. I told my mother about that. He asked me to lie about that, which I did initially. And then the next day I told her the truth, and I came clean. I felt guilty about lying to my mother. I'd never done that before. Not in that capacity, right?
Yeah.
You know, children tell fibs all the time, but not right. anything. Like, that's right. heavy, right?
Right.
And I was 11 years old at the time. And my mother then ended up filing for divorce because he had crossed this line in the sand. And things were very tenuous in the household from then on out. And my father, you know, the holidays had come. This is New Year's Eve. And my father showed up that night with my grandmother, who is his mother, my mother's like almost best friend. Like, you would think that was her mother. And it was a very odd time, but you know, they were going through this divorce, and she, you know, I went to bed that night like every normal kid, kissed my mother goodnight, kissed my grandmother goodnight, love you guys, blah, blah, blah. And I wake up in the middle of the night to this scream and these two loud thuds that I hear about 60 seconds apart. And I knew right then that something had happened to my mother, but something kept telling me, like, don't get up, stay where you're at. And I'm looking at the clock and it says 3:18 a.m. I have this like Batman clock on my wall. And I counted 12 footsteps as they walked down the hall, and I could see out of my peripheral vision the feet in my doorway, because I always slept with my door open as a child. And something just told me, as I'm sitting there, don't look up. The feet left the doorway. I ended up somehow going back to sleep. I woke up a few hours later, sun is out. I ran straight to my mother's bedroom. I noticed that the sheets are all in disarray. I'm looking for blood stains. I'm in that mode right then and there. And my mother's nowhere to be seen. I come downstairs and I ask my father. He's sitting on our couch and he has a towel wrapped around his waist. He had just taken a shower. And I said, where is my mother? And he didn't say anything. And so I asked him again. I said, where is my mother? And he looked up at me and just said, well, Collier, mommy took a little vacation. And I knew right then and there that, not maybe that he had murdered her, but he did something to her. So he ends up going into this whole diatribe about how we're not going to call the police, we're not going to call the FBI, which I thought was the weirdest thing, like, because we're in this small town. I'm thinking, why are we escalating FBI? My grandmother comes in and she's saying, well, you know, listen to your father. And he's telling me, we're not going to call anyone, we're not going to alert anyone. And I'm like, as soon as you're out this door, I'm calling everybody I know. Right. You better believe it.
And you're 11.
And I was 11.
Okay.
And I, a few months before that, I had prepped a list of all of my mother's friends' phone numbers. And I hid them into a stuffed Garfield that I had. And my father left. My grandmother said, don't call anyone. But my mother had just bought a cordless phone. I grabbed the cordless phone, I ran up to my bedroom, I grabbed that list, and I locked myself in the bathroom. And I called every one of my mother's friends that was on that list. And I said, look, I said, I'm not allowed to call the police, but I would prefer if you did. A couple hours later, two uniformed officers show up. Of course, my grandmother's like, you call the police. I'm, no, I didn't call the police. I didn't call the police. And I was trying to explain to them what had happened and what I had heard. And the my father's proclivity for violence, my father's the aggressive nature in which he behaved towards us, and how things were getting progressively worse and worse in the divorce. They just kind of looked at me and were just like, you know, you're a kid. And they left. Next day, I follow up with my father comes home that night. It's very odd behavior. He's speculating on where my mother could have gone, and could she have gone to, you know, just very, very bad, very, very odd behavior from him. And he, the next day, I call my mother's friends again. And I say, you know, what's going on? They're like, okay, we filed a missing persons report. And I'm like, okay, well, it's not a missing persons case. Like, something has happened to her. Like, my father has done something to her. I'm like, okay. And by the grace of God, a detective by the name of Lieutenant David Messmore at that time, it's a New Year's Eve day in a sleepy small town in Ohio. And Dave Messmore sees this missing persons report come across the desk and goes, ah, this is interesting. Doctor's wife goes missing on New Year's Eve. I'm not doing anything. We go look into this. He showed up at my door, and my grandmother, of course, is just, she's furious because and he's very charming, and he sort of, you know, gains his way into our house. And I'm like, come on in, let me talk to you. And my grandmother leaves to go call my father. She's like, I'm going to call my son. And my mother had told me growing up, the stories of when she would go to the carousel horses as a child. And she grew up, my whole family is from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And she would say, you go on the carousel, and the goal of the carousel is you ride the carousel and you try to grab the brass ring. You want to win the brass ring. She'd always say, grab the brass ring, Collier, when you can. I knew at that moment, when my grandmother left and I was sitting here just with Dave, that that was the brass ring moment. And I said to him, I said, look, my mother would never leave me. Something has happened to her. Give me your card, because I'm going to school tomorrow and I will contact you. And he's kind of looking at me, much like you're like, who is this kid? But okay. My grandmother comes back. She yells at him, blah, blah, blah. She's like, you need to leave. And he goes, okay, cool. No problem. He's like, I'll come back later to talk to the doctor, which he did come back later, but my father didn't talk to him. So the next day I go to school. And the first thing I do is I go to the principal's office. I hand them the card. I say, I need you to call this guy. Dave Metzger comes down to the school, and I proceed to outline the entirety of my life story and the entirety of my parents' relationship and my father's history, like I said, proclivity for violence, the way that he treated my mother and I, the girlfriend, everything I knew. I just spilled the beans for hours with this guy. And he's, again, looking at me like, this kid's a wealth of information. But my goal was to stress to him is, my mother would not leave me. She didn't just, it's not like they got into a fight, because my father had told me this whole story of my mother came downstairs, and I said, well, what about the sounds that I heard? Oh, she threw her purse at me. And so you heard that hit the wall. And it's not a purse hitting a wall. I mean, what woman in the middle of the night, in the dead of winter in Ohio, throws her credit cards, her purse, walks out the door with no jacket, and he said she went to a car that was waiting at the end of our driveway in the middle of the night without her children. I mean, it was utterly fanciful, right? Yeah. So this ended up spawning an investigation, and I worked with police for over the course of 25 days with myself and David Messmore, and I would gather clues against my father. My father had come home one time and he had nicks all over his hands, so I was making note of that. He told me, he asked me to rub Bengay, which is like a muscle relaxing ointment, on him because he was moving boxes, he said. And so I'm reporting all this. My father's girlfriend was coming over and I was reporting this, and his attorney was coming over. Meanwhile, Dave Messmore is coming every night to talk to him, and he refuses to talk to him and reporters or anything, because it's like, oh, this is a private matter, right? And I'm just literally making notes. And it wasn't until...
And he didn't know you were doing that.
And he didn't know I was doing that.
Okay.
And it wasn't... But I would later come to find out that he sort of started to realize that the heat was coming from somewhere. So halfway through, about around the middle of January 1990, my father says, I have to go pick up paperwork at my office. Do you want to come with me? And I'm like, yeah, of course. I don't want to let you out of my sight, right? So I go to his office with him. It's a school night, whatever. We drive back, and he has to get gas. So he goes, we stop at a gas station. He walks into the gas station, and I'm looking through the windshield at him in the gas station. I start rummaging through his truck. I open up the center console, and I find two photographs. One is of a house that I've never seen before. And the second one is of his girlfriend with her two children sitting in front of a fireplace that's wrapped in plastic. And I knew, I was like, this tells me that this is a new fireplace in a new house. This is someplace that I don't know where this is at. I go to school the next day. I tell Dave Messmore about this. Things then start to get a little tenuous at home. I can tell my father's starting to become more and more under more and more duress. And I think that looking back on it, I think he was like, well, why are they on to me type of thing, right?
Right.
Why? Because Dave Messmore keeps coming to the house and people keep asking questions. And my father, like I said, he's a doctor. He went to University of Pennsylvania. He's an Ivy League educated, brilliant man. Both my parents were brilliant. But, not smart enough than the police, of course, and or his son, for that matter.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And around the 21st of January, 1990, my father says to me, you know, things have been really tough with your mother leaving us. Because it was always, every night, it was always the story of like, your mother has left us in such a state. I can't believe she would do such a thing. And this, and I'm looking at him, I'm like, I don't believe a word you're saying, because I know that you're a pathological liar. Yeah. I've grown up with this.
Yeah.
And he says to me, he goes, you know, I know it's really hard that mommy's left us in this state, and things have been really difficult for you, Collier. So I think what would be really great is I have a medical conference in Florida, and I think we should do a father and son trip. And I knew right then and there that I was not coming back from Florida.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And because every year we would go to Clearwater Beach, Florida for a medical convention, but those were in the spring. They weren't 3 weeks after Christmas. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because they're in the spring, because it's spring break, it's time, so families can go to Busch Gardens, the beach, etc. Right? And I called Dave Messmore the next day from school, and I said, he wants to take me to Florida, and I'm not coming back. I've been able to swim since I was 4 years old. I'm going to drown in the Gulf of Mexico, or something's going to happen to me. Which I later learned, much later, during my podcast, when I interviewed the judge for my father's trial, that my father had a fixer in Florida, and that most likely would have fixed me too. So on the morning of January 24th, 1990, two members of Child Protective Services showed up at my house at 6 a.m., woke me up out of bed and said, you've got 20 minutes to pack a bag. And my mother and father had adopted a little girl from Taiwan about 6 months before that, so I had a sister, Elizabeth, at the time. And I packed her bag, and I said, what about my dog? Can I get my dog? They said, we'll come back for your dog. I never saw my dog again. In fact, I never saw my house again. And I came down the stairs, and I could hear my grandmother carrying on the entire house. It's flooded with men and women in white lab coats, machines, all kinds of gadgets, things, police cars all outside in the street. And I'm getting a little emotional. Sorry.
Yeah.
I realized at that point that even though I knew, you know, your intuition tells you, like, things aren't going to be the same, and there's, like, a finality at that point. Like, okay. Like,
it's over.
Like, it's, like, life as you know it is over, buddy. Yeah. And I went that night. I was a heavily asthmatic child. I was heavily asthmatic as a child. And that night I went to stay at the principal of my school's house. And I had the worst asthma attack of my life. I thought I was going to die because I forgot my medicine at the house.
Oh.
And I ended up somehow making it through the night, obviously, and I go to the hospital in the morning. And I remember going into this hospital, and my father worked at this hospital, and the lobby was flooded with people. There was an honor box, and for those members of your audience that don't know, but we used to put newspapers in things called honor boxes, where you put the quarter in, you take one newspaper, it's an honor of taking one newspaper, right? So I remember they just kind of pulled me past that very awkwardly, so I wouldn't see it, which I thought, oh, okay, looking back, like, oh, this is odd. And they stabilized me. They gave me some medication. A friend of the family who was a cardiologist, gave me my asthma treatment. And then they told me, they said, Lieutenant Messmore found your mother, and she was dead. And I think this is the thing that is really difficult to articulate with people that go through trauma, or people that haven't been through something like this, is the cognitive dissonance that you go through in that moment. Because in one sense, you have this overwhelming feeling of emotion, like you have this overwhelming sense of relief that you weren't crazy, like you weren't gaslighting right. yourself, that like something happened to your mother, that you were right. And then it also hits you that what you knew to be true in your heart was the truth.
Oh.
And I mean, there's the rub, as they say, right? But that was the thing, and that's when it just really hit me that, you know, okay, like, I don't know what life is going to look like right now. I really don't. And I ended up testifying at the grand jury to secure my father's indictment, because I gathered all this evidence against him and witnessed the murder. And I thought that would have carried sort of a, that would have put me in, you know, like my family would have rallied around that. But instead, I was excoriated for it. My mother's side of the family had told me, we don't want anything to do with you because you look like your father. Literally told me that verbatim.
Oh my gosh.
My mother's sister. My father's side of the family wanted me to recuse my statements because I had framed my father and said, you're gonna take all this back. And I was like, that's not going to happen. So I was thrown into the foster care system, and where I remained for almost a year. I testified at my father's trial against my father for 2 days. After a month-long trial, he was convicted of my mother's murder, and he is still incarcerated to this day.
He still is?
Yeah. It's been 33 years.
33 years. So how old is he now?
My father just turned 80 this year.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Do you have any contact with him?
I have. So how we fast forward all of this is, you know, I stayed in the same small town that all of this happened. So it was very interesting. And when I share my story, and when I share it with like coaching clients, or when I share it with my podcast, I have a podcast called Moving Past Trauma. I have another podcast called Survivor Squad with Tara Newell, who your audience might know from Dirty John fame. She's the one who took Dirty John Meehan's life in self-defense. When we talk to these people, and I talk on my YouTube channel, I share how, you know, living in this situation, it's almost like you're a child actor, like a celebrity, but you're a celebrity for all the wrong reasons. Like, and the moving past all of this is you have to find that way of like, what am I going to do with this story? Because I can't change this story, right? And I think a lot of times that people, not to jump ahead, but a lot of times people in life, yeah, they're very haunted by the past. And a lot of times you just have to embrace that and understand that that is part of what got you to where you're at.
Right.
So for me, I went through this process of like, what is this going to look like? And I dove heavily into the arts. I was like the high school choir teacher. I was finally adopted when I was 13 by a great family. And I was, you know, but it's tough growing up in that situation. We couldn't go anywhere without anyone knowing, you know, whispers, oh, there he is, oh, there's the kid. You know, you have that, right? And I was determined. I was like, you know, I'm gonna do something with story. I don't know what it's gonna look like, but I'm going to do something with this. I ended up graduating high school, going to music school, and about 2.5 years into that, I said, first of all, I'm in Ohio, and I'm like, weather sucks here.
Right.
I'm going west. You know, I remember listening to the Beach Boys when I was a kid, and my mother loved the ocean, and I loved the ocean. And I said, I'm going to move to Los Angeles and just figure it all out. And that's what I did. And over this time, I maintained a relationship with my father. And it went through a metamorphosis of sorts. But one of the things that became very clear to me is that, and this is probably obvious, but, you know, he's a very disturbed individual. But the haunting thing, because when you grow up in a situation like this, when people learn your story, they wonder if you're capable of the same thing. Does the apple fall far from the tree or not? So my relationship history with girls that I was dating, and always when this would come up, is of course the father, and I don't blame them, by the way, like this is just human nature, like they're concerned, like, right, oh, right. You're dating someone whose dad murdered his mother and buried her, because they dug my mother's body up underneath that house that I found the photograph of.
Oh my gosh.
My father had buried her underneath the basement floor of this house. And police had to excavate her body out of a makeshift grave.
Oh,
it was buried underneath indoor-outdoor carpeting, shelves. He had redesigned this whole basement of this house around my mother's grave because my father is a psychopath. And he wanted... It's hard to reconcile because... And I was doing a therapy session the other day. And my therapist asked me if I was angry with my father. I said, I'm not... I said, of course, there's anger there, right? But you know, I made a conscientious choice long ago to forgive my father, because I realized that forgiveness. A lot of people feel like forgiveness is disempowering, is yielding something, because we have this ego, right? And we're like, oh, I'm not going to acknowledge this and that.
Right.
And you have to realize it's not about them. You are not. saying what they did was okay. You are not accepting. You are saying it has no power over me.
Yes, right.
That's the true nature of forgiveness, right? And I know that this channel has a religious tone to it, but
you're right.
Jesus died on the cross and said, I forgive you. You know what I mean? That's real power, right?
Right.
This has no power over me.
Right.
And I had to do that with my father. But one of the steps in that also was coming to that realization that I was not capable of doing what he did. And I maintained this relationship for 26 years. And I created a film called A Murder in Mansfield, directed by two-time Oscar winner Barbara Koppel. You can get on my website and get on Investigation Discovery, Discovery Plus. But I had to sit down with my father. My entire career. So I moved to Hollywood. I became a filmmaker, a cinematographer. I learned everything about the film business. Because when you go into that room and I sit down across from my father, everything that I have done in my life, from the point when they said when I knew that my mother was missing on December 31st to that moment in the film, everything led up to that. Everything I had done was to get to that point so I could sit down with my father and say, and hold his feet to the fire and say, why, Dad? Why did you do this? Because I thought, despite the forgiveness, that I needed to really know that.
Right.
And not to spoil it, but I don't get that in that way. Or I get what some people call a rolling confession. But my father, hidden beneath his layers of deception and narcissism and self-protection and incarceration, is someone that just can't admit the truth and can't accept the truth. And I realize that, I have a tattoo on my arm that says, the truth will set you free, but not until it is finished with you. It's a David Foster Wallace quote. And I got it after the film because I realized, I didn't need that at all. I was good where I was. I am not that man.
You thought you needed it, but you don't.
I didn't
need it.
I didn't need it.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So he still does not say it.
No.
He doesn't admit it.
No.
Is it the kind of thing, I don't know anything about psychopaths.
That's a good thing.
I'm not that I want to study them. But is it the kind of deal where actually in his mind, he may not, he may have walled off to a point where he actually doesn't think he did it even though he did? Does that happen?
So there's this film that came out in the early 2000s called Meet Joe Black. And Brad Pitt meets this actress, Claire Forlani, and they have this great interaction. It's instant romance. And then he walks off and he gets hit by a bus. It just takes you, it's a very shocking scene in the film. But he comes back and she sees him and he doesn't know who she is. And it's this weird sort of cerebral thing. Maybe it plays into the afterlife or whatever. But I equate it to that in the sense that people who go through extreme trauma, and my father, going back to what I said with my therapist the other day, are you angry at him? I'm angry that he did this to himself because there was no reason to. And I think when we look at violence, I talk a lot about true crime. I talk a lot about the consequences of violence. That was why I was impassioned to make A Murder in Mansfield, is we try to understand these things in a way, but I think when you go through something like that, even though you're the perpetrator, your mind blocks it. It's so horrific to take someone's life, to strangle them and to smash the back of their skull in. Someone who had been in your life for 25 years that you have a child with. And we see this a lot because people are fascinated with true crime and fascinated with the psychology. It's a big thing, right?
Right.
And to see, to really understand that, first of all, you don't really want to understand it. But you have to understand that that's you're a person that's capable of empathy and understanding and compassion. And my father was such a great doctor, but things like that feed into the nature of his psychopathy, the nature of his narcissism. He was a malignant narcissist, right? And they're all personality disorders, etc. So it is one of those things that you realize that I'm not capable of that, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So you're 11 years old, you're on the witness stand. So
I was 12 when I went to trial.
Okay.
This is the photograph. That's me.
Oh my gosh.
And your audience, you know, I was on an episode of Forensic Files, which is a very famous true crime show, and they have me on the stand because it's, you know, I testified at trial as a child, testifying against one parent who's killing another parent, who's killed another parent, you know, and it's a very, thank God, it's a very rare situation.
You know? Yeah.
You know.
So what has been, just real quickly, your personal journey? I mean, obviously, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, you lose both parents, essentially.
Yeah.
What has it been like for you in terms of all these years later now? Like, where are you at?
So, this is sometimes a hard pill for people to swallow. But I say this all the time, and I say this in interviews to people. Despite everything and the horrific nature of what I've been through and the horror, I wouldn't change anything. In a personal level. Like, I would change it for my family, of course, in the community and everything, like, selfishly I'm talking about.
Right.
I wouldn't change anything because I genuinely like the person who I am today.
Yeah.
And that has given me the strength. And you know, it's taught me so much about the afterlife even, or spirituality. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not particularly religious, but I am spiritual. Mm-hmm. And I know that my mother surrounds me, and I know that I... You know, one of the most amazing things about doing my film and my podcast, despite my family's abandonment, I've had ancillary relatives, people that were like second cousins, reach out to me. And I was in New York last year for a film premiere, and I went to meet one of them for the first time, and I got out of the taxi, and she just looked at me, and she said, "Oh my God, you are a spitting image of your mother. It's like I'm talking to Noreen." You know how good that makes me feel?
Yeah.
Like, as someone who struggled their whole life to, like, am I this dark person that my father is, or do I have my... I mean, I know I have my mother's light inside of me, but to have that reaffirmed by someone, to have that just... That's the thing that just strikes them instantaneously, meeting me for the first time in their life. Like,
beautiful.
It just... It's amazing. So, yeah, where I'm at is this place of... I mean, look, I do I want to be more successful? Do I want to have a big YouTube channel? Do I want to have all the successful podcast? Of course, I want all the material things. But in the spiritual and where I am in my life and who I am, you know, I could walk out in the street and get hit by a bus tomorrow and say, you know what? I left a positive mark on this world.
Right.
I mean, forever in the annals of history is me confronting my father and also giving him the opportunity to tell the truth, because my father had thought that I was making a film to help him get out of prison. I didn't tell him that, but he looks at things that way. It's all about him. And I gave him ultimately the opportunity to come clean for himself. I'm begging him in the film to, like, please do this. You have this golden opportunity. He wouldn't take it. And to be able to immortalize that and to show the world that you can go through unspeakable trauma, circumstances that most people can't even fathom, and come out okay on the other side, that's a gift to be able to share with people.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Oh my gosh. So you sat across from him.
Just like we are now.
Oh my gosh. Did you share anything personal with him, or was it just about the...
In the scene, you know, I've been on my Hollywood journey, and I was, I was working with a writer from a very big television show, and I was like, I really want to make a scripted series out of this. So we made a pilot, and one of the things in developing the character of my father, I had given this writer a box full of my father's letters, because one of the things I read on my podcast and I share, which is tremendously helpful for my audience, because a lot of people have gone through, you know, abusive relationships with their parents, narcissistic parents, attachment issues, anxious attachment, is I read my father's letters to show what manipulation and gaslighting and narcissism look like, because it's just so overt in these letters, right? These relating to a child, blaming a child for why he's in prison and things. And then but they also shift and morph over the years, right? And I allowed this writer to go through the box of letters, but we found one letter in particular, and I didn't even look at it. but we use it as our hero letter in this little short film that we did, and which was a pilot, which nothing ever happened with, but I ended up making the documentary. And I thought, when I was discussing with my director, Barbara Koppel, because she's won 2 Academy Awards, and we're discussing this, like, okay, we're going to get into the prison, and I'm going to sit down with my father, and how's this going to go? And I said, you know what? I said, art always imitates life, but it would be really cool if life imitated art, because we use this letter as our hero letter in this other movie, in this little thing that we, little short film that we made. I said, what if I read this letter? I said, I'm going to give it to you because I haven't looked at this letter since I wrote it to him when I was 13 years old. And in the letter, I had asked him to come clean about the murder for himself, for my family, for me, for his girlfriend, for my half-sister that was born 12 days before he was arrested, for our whole family, for the community, so everyone could move on. I knew that at 13, 14 years old, that these are the tools that people need and the grace that they need. And what did he do? He opened up that letter, put it back in the envelope, signed his signature, and wrote refused, and sent it back to me. So I always held that. So I pull out that letter with him. And when I sit down in the film, you know, we're having this very cordial conversation. I'm talking about the crappy Ohio weather in December. And, you know, living in California, we get spoiled, right? And but I say to him, I said, one of the things that I've always been curious about, ever since you murdered my mother, it's the first time I've ever said that to him. And I had a relationship, like I said, for 26 years with my father. I would go to see him in prison regularly, phone calls, letters, emails, videos. When I was cultivating making this film, I went into the prison years before because they had a production department and taught them how to film, taught them how to use editing software, taught them how to use Adobe Photoshop, all these things.
Really?
To get into good graces with them. And I say to him, ever since you murdered my mother, and it's like all the air gets sucked out of the room. And I said, I want to read this letter to you. And I open up the letter. And it's the first time I've looked at it since I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. And I read it to him. And it's this plea of him just to come clean. And I ask him, I said, you refused this. Why did you do that? And then he spills into this whole thing about him. it's amazing. It's amazing in all the wrong ways. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean that, you know, lightheartedly. It's very sad is what it is.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now and how it's helping other people. Because that's what obviously has been amazing out of this, is how, you're right, people are fascinated with crime and murder and so forth. But they're also impacted by trauma,
yeah,
like in huge numbers. I mean, yeah, probably nothing like what you've experienced, but bad stuff happens.
Of course, and I appreciate you saying that. But this is the thing I tell people, you know, I am the exception, not the rule. And just because I've been through some crazy, crazy circumstance, doesn't make someone else's experience any less.
Right.
You know, I tell this to coaching clients. I tell this to guests on my podcast. I tell this to audience members, to, you know, my community. I say, like, you have your own, you're your own human being. You're your own experience, right? I mean, there are people that I see that have moved through horrific things, like dealing with childhood cancer or disabilities, yeah, or things that I think, wow, like, wow, yeah, that takes so much metal. You know, that takes so much chutzpah and so much courage. Like, I admire that. You know, it brings me to tears sometimes to think about things like that. You know, we all feed off of that really courageous energy, right? But the thing is that me sharing my story, and I always say this on my podcast, and my thing is, look, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not law enforcement, I'm just a guy who's been through a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I share it with that perspective, whether it be true crime, whether it be, you know, mental health, whether it be pop culture, whether, you know, everything through my lens has been shaped through my worldview, which is going through, as they say in Shawshank Redemption, crawling through a river of shit and coming out clean the other side.
Right.
It's literally that.
Right.
And that's the things that I offer my community, my audience, is learning from those things and applying that to your own life. Like, okay, because I wished that when I was in foster care in the nadir of my life, staring into this void that sends nothing back to you, not knowing if I was going to make it, like I have to testify at trial, I'm in an abusive foster care situation, my family has abandoned me, I don't know what's going to happen, and what if my father gets off? Then I'm going to go back into his custody and I'm sure I'm going to be abused for the rest of my life. There's the other flip side to that coin.
Right.
And so I'm dealing with all of this, and I wished I could have pulled up a video on a social media site,
right,
or listened to something on a podcast,
right,
and said, oh, right, somebody's been through it too, man. Oh, right, thank God.
Right.
There was a young man that contacted me a couple years ago who had seen the documentary. And it was weird because on Instagram, you're going through and there's messages that you don't see. And all of a sudden, all these messages populated. And his father had taken the life of his mother. It was a completely different circumstance. There was, it was a sort of botched murder-suicide type thing, and the father had a brain disorder and things, and but he was thinking about taking his own life. In fact, he was planning on it, and he just happened to turn on his television one day, and on the day that he was thinking, like, I'm going to do this, and he saw a murder in Mansfield, and he's like, Wait, hold on. The dad killed the mom? And he watched it, and he goes, I'm still here.
Wow.
And again, I talk about, like, oh, I want this financial success, the rewards, all the things from my hard work and the work that I'm doing and stuff. But those things, man,
right.
Those are things you cannot put a price on.
Yeah.
Impacting someone's life like that, that hears your story,
right,
and that makes a choice. And on the flip side of, and that's why I wanted to do the film. That's why I wanted to share my story, because I felt so impassioned, not only through my youth, but in my young adult life, to that we don't look at the consequences of violence. We don't think about things in that terms. And I thought, on the kid who was, and I want to speak to that kid who's in foster care, who thinks that, like, what am I going to do? What's going to happen? Okay, I'm going to be okay. But also, what about the person that's struggling with doing something like that? Maybe they think that's their only way out. My father's, the murder of my mother was premeditated. A lot of people don't understand the complete story with that, but it was not a crime of passion. My father planned this for months and months and months. My passion extends to people who are thinking about doing something because they don't think they have a way out.
Yeah.
Maybe it gives them pause, 2 seconds of pause, right, like, oh, if I do this, what happens to my child? What happens to my mother that I'm responsible for taking care of? What happens to my friends at work? They know me, they have to face this. And if it gives them just a moment to reframe, reconsider options, things, like, there's other ways to deal with this,
it's worth
that's it. A miracle.
Yeah. That is, yeah. The there's redemption. Speaking of Shawshank Redemption, but I've come to the place. We had a difficult situation with a daughter and with a special needs kind of situation. But I've said this is what you said about that situation, and sometimes I get weird looks where I've said I wouldn't change it. If I could take her back to the womb and not have 2/3 of her brain wiped out and have her walk and talk normally and be, I wouldn't change it. That to me is when there's something godlike that's happened where he's involved, because I can't explain how that situation could be redeemed. If you'd taken me back 21 years, for you to say that in terms of what's happened, obviously you don't wish it on your mom and your family, but you, with what's happened with you as a human being, that you would, like, that is an amazing victory in a sense over the thing. Are you understand what I'm saying?
100%. It's
which
enlightenment.
Is incredible.
It's a higher state, and not to sound, solipsistic or heavy handed or anything, but it is it's a phase of enlightenment that many people don't get to.
Yeah.
To really be able to step back and go, oh, this is what it's about.
Something different.
Something different.
There's somebody who said, you know, if you allow it, suffering can take you to a place you never otherwise would have gone, in a good way. I mean, obviously, now suffering can break you and
sure.
forget about it. You know, that happens all over the world every second.
It does.
But there's a chance. I mean, and that's what I see with, like, with the podcast and your movie and your work. I see that kid who had that situation where he's thinking about it. There's a chance. Give, you know, if you just wait 2 seconds, or if you think about it for, like, you're helping people to pause and go, you know what? There's a chance that this could be redeemed. There's a chance that the light could break through, that something could happen in you that never otherwise would have happened. You know what I'm saying? That's a miracle to me.
It is. And it's also, you know, and maybe it's naive, but it's how I view the world. It's so weird because, you know, when the film came out and I'm traveling around the world and I'm speaking, and this is, like, obviously, like, right before we went into the pandemic lockdown mode, I remember just thinking to myself, okay, cool, that's done. Now I can live my life. Now I can just do with it. Now I can right. do, like, you tick that box and you go, okay, that's done. And most people were like, well, yeah, you're 40 years old. Like, what do you mean? I'm like, yeah, but now I can do, like, I closed that chapter. And people are just like, yeah, so now I'm ready to, like, that's how I think of things. And when you talk about the chance, I remember Dumb and Dumber, that movie that came out years ago. And Jim Carrey is talking to the girl and she's like, he's like, did you ever see that we could be together? And she goes, he's like, you know, she's like, he's like, 1 in 1,000. She's like, more like 1 in 1,000,000. And he goes, so you're telling me there's a chance. That's the thing.
Right.
It's there always is.
Right.
And it's so hard. And look, I am not sitting here pontificating, saying that I live this very perfect life and I don't get down in the dumps and things don't drag me into the depths where I go, oh, God, I got to just, but then you just kind of reframe it and you go, but I'm still breathing. I was driving up here today, and I live in Santa Monica, also on the ocean, and I'm thinking about the drive, and there's traffic and stuff, and I don't particularly care for LA traffic, but I'm thinking about, but I'm also thinking at the same time, and I wasn't, like, cursing or I don't get upset by that type of thing, because I look at it and I go, like, I'm driving in my car, I have a roof over my head, I have food, I have, I'm doing work that, you know, hopefully sometimes pays the bills, but it impassions me. I'm coming to speak to someone like yourself who's, it's called Good Life. Yeah. What is better than Good Life, right?
Right.
And this is the good life.
Right.
And this is the thing. And this is what I want to convey to people is, like, there's these moments where you have, it's almost like you take it back and go, oh, well, guess what? In the car, I can listen to music uninterrupted for the next hour and a half. Or I can catch up on that audiobook. Or I can just be still with myself and my thoughts and almost meditate. I mean, pay attention to the road, but think about things and just be really grateful. Really, I think you started the program off saying, I'm grateful to be here.
Yeah.
I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful for this opportunity to speak to you, speak to your audience. That's the thing we got to keep in mind. And it's, and I think that when I say something like that, it carries weight. I think when you say something, given what you and your family have been through, it gives that weight, right?
Do you speak?
Gravitas.
Do you speak?
I do, yeah. I'm speaking next week at a conference.
You need to speak a lot.
I want to speak more. I will speak anywhere.
Yeah,
I love the sound of my own voice.
I think you should definitely, because, man, what a story. In the reading you just in the last 40 minutes, like, you're brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
And you, but then this heart, you have this heart that, again, suffering can harden, just forget about it, can send you that direction. So to still have a tender heart with a brilliant mind in the story you have, like, you should be all over the place. Like, just my
your lips to God's ears.
That's right.
Friend.
Let's do it. Well, I am honored to meet you. We're gonna put up the stuff on the screen, but for sure, go to Collier Landry. So Collier Landry, Collier Landry, LANDRY.com. Find his YouTube channel. Find the podcast. Moving Past Trauma is what it's called now?
It is, yeah.
Moving Past Trauma. The movie is, or the documentary, is Murder in Mansfield. I'd highly encourage you to check it all out. And again, CollierLandry.com.
Or at Collier Landry, everywhere.
Or at Collier Landry, all the social media platforms. You need them to come speak to your organization is what I would suggest, because talk about redemption. We didn't even get to Shawshank Redemption. We're going to have him on again. Just talk about that.
My pleasure.
A favorite movie of both of ours. Story of redemption, story of forgiveness, story of power, story of a man who has a heart of flesh with a brilliant mind after all that he's been through. Talk about hope. Talk about no such thing as false hope. Andy Dufresne, you know. Like Andy Dufresne on steroids. And this is real. This actually happened. I can't even believe it. Amazing to meet you. Thank you.
A real pleasure. Yeah, thank you, sir.
And thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.